I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the serial entrepreneur Gary Kremen. Gary is the founder of Match.com, an online dating service that he started in 1993. Gary is also the founder of Clean Power Finance, an online marketplace for the solar energy sector, and Sociogramics, a financial services company that uses social media and behavioral economics to provide capital to consumers who don't otherwise have access to credit. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
I'd like to start with your upbringing. You grew up in Chicago. What did your parents do?
Both of my parents were teachers in the Chicago public school system. My dad was a driver's ed instructor. My mom taught accounting 37 years for my father.
What were you like as a kid?
Probably bratty. I was kind of a habitual problem child. While I was a good student, I ended up at the police a couple times. I remember one of my claims to fame is I broke all these windows and the police picked me up and made me go to the property owners and apologize. And me and a friend sat in the cell. And then another time we climbed the roof of our elementary school and broke a window and they took money from the Coke machine. I mean, I got kicked out of school for changing a program. And this was in the 70s and printing out some profanity. And that was that kind of intellectual problem child.
Did you have girlfriends growing up?
I had one girlfriend, but I wasn't very good at it, and maybe Match.com was my way of trying to the idea of online dating was my way of kind of maybe more getting more deal flow, as we call it today.
What were some odd jobs that you had as a kid?
I spent years actually working after school in a warehouse loading and unloading trucks. Mm. In fact, I worked for this guy who was a pretty good entrepreneur who did things like when Burger King had a misprint on glasses they were handing out. Like there was a misspelling. He would buy them all at 3 cents on a dollar and sell them in loco bodegas, you know. And I would be loading and unloading trucks for him for years and years and years. And when Pan Am went out of business, he bought all the little tchotchkes, like the little pins they gave kids and all the safety vests that were under the seat and found buyers for it. Mm-hmm. So that was like probably my first example of someone who could figure out how to make a profit in the situation.
You went to Northwestern. You graduated in 1985 and then made your way to Stanford Business School. Why do you think Stanford Business School accepted you?
Well, I talked about being an entrepreneur, and I had kind of an unconventional background because out of undergraduate, I decided I wanted to work in a nonprofit looking for fraud, mismanagement, and waste in the Department of Defense. And I think that was different from the normal investment bankers and consultants they had.
But you did work at Goldman Sachs one summer.
I did.
During Stanford Business School, and you rubbed one of the managing directors the wrong way, such that they offered to pay you to leave. What happened there?
They did. They offered to buy my summer out after about week four to leave them alone. I don't know if I rubbed one person wrong. I think I rubbed everyone wrong.
So did you kind of get a rise from challenging authority? Was this something that you liked to perpetuate, or this is just, you know, Gary Kremen?
Just the way I am, that sometimes me being there 4 weeks, I thought I knew as much as, you know, managing partners that have been there 20 years.
After graduating from Stanford Business School in 1989, you started two companies because you knew you were better off with your own gig. The first was a software company and then a computer securities company called Los Altos Technologies. And it was at Los Altos where the idea for an online dating company hatched. Can you explain how the idea for Match.com came to you?
So I had an epiphany one day. I noticed that we started getting purchase orders for our products. And I noticed that one day we got a purchase order from a woman. Mm-hmm. And that never happened in my history before, that actually getting email on the internet from some woman. And we're sitting around the office thinking, I wonder if, you know, what she's like and if there's any way we could learn more about her. And I realized that, oh, more women were going to get on the internet, because back then there were hardly any on the internet. And I realized, I wonder if I could create a database of all the women who are coming online and sell access to it and then marry number one.
Hmm.
Sort. Marry number one.
And marry number one.
That's right.
This was the first woman, the woman who placed this order. Did you think you might marry her? Or
she could have been, and I was curious. So I wonder if I could convince her I wonder if I could get her zip code. I had it. Actually, I had her zip code. I wonder if I could find the closest Kinko's, convince her to go scan her picture in, and then do a write-up on her. Hmm. So that was kind of some of my first ideas.
Because this certainly was top of mind was finding a mate.
Top of mind was finding a mate. And then just not me. I noticed there was a market in it on both sides. So at about the same time, I did my first good setup. I set up a friend with another friend, and they got married. I was like, wow, I wonder if they should have paid me for that whole process.
You at the time were also active in telephone dating services. You would pay $2.99 a minute for these 1-900 numbers. How did they work?
So there were newspapers out there, a lot of the alternative newspapers. All they were a little bit of content around these listings for 900 numbers, and you would read a little short description. You would call, paying $2.99 a minute to hear a description, a more detailed description, and then leave a message. And I realized a lot of people who own not only these newspapers, but other newspapers and classified, so were more richer than me. In fact, I didn't have too much money, but they did, and I wanted some of their money.
In 1993, you started a company called Electric Classifieds Incorporated with Match.com as your first service, and the idea was to take offline classifieds and put them online.
That's right. I realized that newspapers would be slow. I went to go talk to a couple of them, and I said, if I have all these domain names, I could create brands around each categories and put these newspapers out of business.
So your first subset of this electronic classifieds was Match.com, this online dating idea, and you bought the domain name for $2,500, which at the time was a pretty hefty number. Only 5% of Americans had internet access. How did you go about buying the domain name? From whom?
So, first I used my credit card cash advance, as many entrepreneurs do. And I found the guy who was registered to, some person in Las Vegas who tried to do something in email and dating, and it never happened. And I think I came out of the blue like some sucker who was willing to write a check for something that had no value. I had this vision that I could do this whole thing through email, and you could say send picture of person number 27 and the picture would show up. And actually, that's what happened. That's how the early days were before the web.
Right, because this was an email dating service before the World Wide Web became more popular.
In fact, most people didn't even know the web was going to be. There were some alternate ideas, things called links and Archie, and no one knew where it was going to evolve. Mm. So we built a system that could talk to many different protocols, including faxes. People could fax in, and we'd use optical character recognition and realize what they were asking for. But eventually, the email service took off. We're growing at 3-4% a day.
How did the email service take off? Who were some of those early adopters?
Well, I realized something from talking to friends of mine, women friends, that I was able to kind of understand what some of their needs were in this area that was kind of a tough area, which is putting yourself out online where everyone could see what you were looking for, which was kind of a taboo area. I realized that privacy, security, and anonymity were very important. So I kind of came up with the idea of the anonymous handle that would have email and really focusing on respect in the process and the belief that one woman would bring 100 men, at least back then.
So give an example. So, Janet Smith wants to find a boyfriend, so she emails you, Gary, her picture.
Or maybe she just emails her biographical info, and we would do matching in our database to find out who would be looking for someone like Janet Smith around her, and we would send her the list in email.
So you would look at a database, just a list of guys who had signed up?
Now, it was done by an algorithm that we wrote and everything like that. But, yeah, basically that was the idea. It's called matching. We matched.
Were you a participant in this?
No, actually, by that time, I actually had a girlfriend, which was hard to believe, but I did have one. So I was more of a looking at the process, but I wasn't touching the goods, so to speak.
I see.
Now, she did touch the goods and married someone from the service.
Now, at the time, you had a girlfriend, so you were using Match.com. Have you ever used Match.com?
I've never used it. Not that I'm against the idea or anything like that. It was just the circumstances.
You are married now.
I am.
And you have two children, two boys. How did you meet your wife?
I met my wife through a mutual friend who didn't know that we were each interested. So what I did when I realized I really need to get married is I made an offer. And if you set me up with the woman I marry, you get a trip to Hawaii for two.
Who did you make the offer to?
Everyone I knew.
What is her name and what does she do?
Her name's Petia, and she's a physician who specializes in integrative and holistic healthcare. I knew she was the one. And I think, you know, maybe by date four, she knew I was the one. You know, after we worked some those issues out, like the dog thing and stuff like that.
I remember when I first was learning about Match.com that there was a stigma attached to, oh, joining Match.com. And people were kind of embarrassed by it. That seems to have dissipated over the years now. How many marriages and how many successful matches have there been?
So probably successful matches in the millions, definitely the same number of marriages, but the stigma was the biggest obstacle to success. And worked pretty hard to make it a safe, secure, and friendly place and kind of change behaviors and beliefs that this is a positive, not a negative. It's definitely a feature, not a bug.
So what were some examples of things that you did to try to mitigate that stigma?
Absolute privacy, booting creepy people off quickly, throttling the amount of emails people could send to others, doing good matches, telling people if there was no match, there was just no match. Truthfulness, transparency.
The service, the email service, as well as the website eventually, started really growing 3-4% a day, really through word of mouth. What was one of those catalysts or turning points that really helped to escalate the popularity and growth of the service?
You know, one that I would say is I like to say we invented affiliate marketing. As far as I know, before we did it, no one came up with the idea of actively going out and marketing links to your website as opposed to marketing your web name and URL. And I was a big believer that let's go get the Women's Wire of the world to have a dating section and we'll be the back end for it. So I think the idea of affiliate marketing, something we all take for granted, was one of the ways we did very well. And two is we kept our service running. I know it's the craziest thing, but it's kind of an entrepreneurial lesson that you could have something great, but if it's not working all the time, it's kind of a suboptimum consumer experience.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is a serial entrepreneur, Gary Kremen. Gary is the founder of Match.com, an online dating service that he started in 1993. We'll hear more from Gary coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is a serial entrepreneur, Gary Kremen. Gary is the founder of Match.com, an online dating service that he started in 1993. In addition to Match.com, you owned a number of generic domain names, jobs.com, housing.com, autos.com, and then sex.com, which was later the subject of a lawsuit. Whom did you acquire these domain names from in the early 1990s?
There was one organization giving them away, and no one thought of going to ask. So I had an epiphany that generic words that are in the classified advertising would be very valuable one day. So there happened to be a little government contractor called Network Solutions in Herndon, Virginia, that somehow wrangled the exclusive right to give out these domain names, and they weren't getting paid per domain name because they were free. They were getting paid by, they would add up their costs and add 20% and charge the National Science Foundation for it. They were basically an office of four or five people who coordinated the handing out of IP addresses and domain names and associated internet artifacts. And they hit on, and I think about 95, that they should be charging $75 from that. That later was bought by VeriSign and became a huge public company just based on the revenue from that.
Did you pick up the phone and call them and say, hey, I want to buy jobs.com?
So I sent in to an email address and I said, I wanted jobs.com, and I filled out a form. And I did that for all the domain names except the one that I did last, which was sex.com. And I realized, okay, I don't want this to get lost in email or someone on the other side to see what a good idea is. So I sent in a certified letter, and that was really good because there was a record of a certified letter.
So going back to Match.com, you raised about $4 million from angel investors and venture capital funds, and they invested in Electric Classifieds, which owned Match.com. And very early on, you and they did not see eye to eye. What are some examples of divergent points of view?
There was a couple different divergent points of view. Divergent point of view number one was, I believe that working with newspapers was doomed to fail. They were slow. They didn't get it in today's vernacular. Most of my board wanted to go work with newspapers, and that's kind of how they thought, well, let's go work with big companies. That's good. And I felt smaller entrepreneurial companies would grab the market, and I was actually right on that. Number two is, once when Match took off, I wanted to focus on that. I wanted to run with the winner. And they were like, well, let's go be the outsource partner for newspapers. And I just felt too slow. We'd never get there.
You owned a number of domain names at the time, jobs.com, housing.com, autos.com, sex.com. And they were fine with putting all these domain names under the auspices of Electric Classifieds, except for sex.com. Why did they not want sex.com in there?
Well, it was one in a many series of embarrassments that traditional stodgy venture capitalists who are backed by pension funds feel. The word sex were embarrassed. When I introduced gay dating, they almost had heart attacks right there and then, and they kind of told me not to do it, and I did it anyhow. When I said not everyone's for marriage, some people are looking for shorter-term relationships, I think I almost got fired that day.
Sex.com ended up being not just a scandalous affair, which we'll get to, but also your most lucrative domain name that you owned.
That's true. That's true. So that was another strategic mistake they made. I mean, I made a lot of my own mistakes, please. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm Mr. Mistake.
So what are some other mistakes that you made in the early days of Match.com?
So didn't understand the importance of who's on your board. Thinking all money is green was a big mistake. And I think I was pretty abrasive as a leader. I mean, I made a lot of leadership mistakes. I think I got the strategy right, for sure, but the tactics I wasn't as good at.
I heard a story that you fired a personal assistant or an administrative assistant because she wouldn't work 7 days a week. Is that true?
That's true, because everyone else was working 7 days a week, and it felt that there's always something to do, even if it's emptying the wastebasket, and I felt that that wasn't team spirit if you're going to take Sundays off. Because I was working Sundays, and I expected everyone else to work Sundays.
You were the CEO of Match.com for the first 2 years before you were ousted by the board.
That's right.
How did you feel when they voted you out?
You know, it hurt my feelings. I think that was one area where they were right. I was not mature enough to see that back then.
But at the time, you were just despondent and thought, these guys don't know what they're talking about.
Well, I have another good story. So when I raised money from the investors I did raise the money from, I had an offer from another set of investors, a more prestigious set of investors, like the best venture funds, Kleiner Perkins, IVP. And their condition on the investment was that I bring in a CEO. They had two conditions. One is bring in a CEO. And they would be let me part of the process. And two, they wanted to merge me with this other company, and I would have half the equity, and these other six people would have the other half of the equity. But no, they taught me in school, you want to be the leader, you want to be the CEO. So I said no. So I took the people who said you could be the CEO. Now that company went on, those six guys went on to change their name from Architects to Excite. And I would have had half of Excite and part Vested too. One of those, you know, couple $100 million mistakes that are common in my career.
And Excite went on to
be Excite worth at home and worth billions at the peak.
You left the company after 2 years, and the company was ultimately sold in 1997 for $7 million to Sendint, which is a consumer service company. And a year and a half later, the company was sold for $50 million to CitySearch Ticketmaster, which is owned by IAC, Barry Diller's Interactive Corporation. You made $50,000 from that sale.
I did.
How did that happen?
Well, it was part of the dispute over what direction the company wanted to do. But actually, the story worked out okay. I'll tell you the whole story. So what happened is I said, no, let's focus on this winter match. Let's have nothing to do with newspapers. We had big fights over it, and the board wanted to do the strategy of enabling newspapers to get online. And after they sold it, after my fervent objective, the company raised lots of money and it went out of business in 2001.
What company?
Match.com's parent, Electric Classifieds. They raised a lot more money trying to sell the newspapers, and it went out of business.
Got it.
So that was bad. But the good thing is I invented a bunch of things, and we got some patents. Like, I invented dynamic web pages, something every website uses today. So in 2004, a couple years later, I went and bought the debt in the last round, and I had a foreclosure sale to get that patent. And some other bidders came in, and I owned enough debt that on my $30,000 investment, I made a couple $1 million. So okay, that's better than a sharp stick in the eye.
So it was more than $50,000 in a very indirect manner.
Yeah, it was very indirect. But the real thing, $50K.
You had given up equity along the way,
ultimately? Yeah. And it's not that anyone else made any money. In fact, I think I was the only one who got any liquidity, even $50K. They all lost everything.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Gary Kremen, the founder of Match.com, the world's largest online dating service. After the sale of Match.com, how were you doing?
Well, I was definitely bumming about the situation, but it was in such a good time in 1997 where a lot was going on. And I did have some unique knowledge. So I started working with a guy or two who had some ideas around collaborative filtering, something we see recommendation engines back then, and got that merged with a company called Firefly, and we eventually sold it to Microsoft.
For how much?
That was, I think, total $40 million. Mm-hmm. So that didn't suck.
Contemporaneous with these successful investments, you had a tumultuous period with a lawsuit over the ownership of sex.com. You had owned the domain name and contended that somebody had fraudulently taken it from you. Can you describe that briefly?
Sure. So I registered the name in 1994, first person who ever registered it. And I wasn't really focusing on it. I had all these other entrepreneurial things I was working on. And one day, someone said, hey, didn't you own that name, sex.com? And I'm saying, yeah. They go, no, this guy, Stephen Michael Cohen, has it's registered under his name. And I'm like, what? And I look it up, and it was true. It did. So I found out Mr. Cohen, who is a 5-time convicted felon, bankruptcy fraud, obstruction of justice, impersonating a judge, impersonating a lawyer, he stole the name from me. And he started, put up a website, and he was soon making about $1 million a month off the name.
Now, at the time, ownership of URLs or of domain names wasn't as secure as it is now, because it was really still the early days. So when you say he stole the name from you, how did that happen?
So initially, this is going to sound dumb, but I didn't realize how valuable the name was. I didn't know anything about the sex industry. I didn't realize it was such a big deal. So I had a little kind of investment firm, and there was a lawyer just fresh out of law school named Sherry Falco, and I gave her $2,500 to go investigate what happened, and that's how the whole thing started. And she found out about this, and then she got a call from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office saying, well, the reason Mr. Cohen now has the name, even whether he took it or not, is he had a trademark on the name. So we let it drop. We found out later that he was impersonating the USPTO, one of many things that he's impersonated in the case. So after
he had called her directly?
Oh, yeah, and said he was from the Patent and Trademark Office. And she believed it, and I believed it, too. And it hit us later that you can't have trademarks on generic words. So eventually we filed this lawsuit.
And so you found yourself associated with the porn industry pretty publicly. What was your view of that?
Well, what can you do? I needed the money. While at the time I was having legal bills of $100,000 or $200,000 a month, I needed financial support for what I was doing. I didn't have liquidity from my investments yet.
And how much of your mind space or of your headspace was this lawsuit taking up while you were trying to focus on your investing?
Well, eventually it took up 110% of my time. I learned the law. I read every brief, every pleading, which there was over 1,700. It's the longest case, I believe, in the Northern District.
When you finally got sex.com back, what did you do with the site until you sold it?
So I didn't want to run an adult site, and I came up with the idea of turning it into a search engine because there was so much traffic, and then selling those search results to other search engines. And eventually I sold it.
Isn't that effectively running an adult site or perpetuating the porn industry?
Okay, I didn't kill the porn industry. I had to eat. I had to pay my $5.6 million of legal bills I had.
And your judgment was $65 million in damages, but you didn't get the $65 million, so...
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, I've still been collecting. So all I got out of it was a lot of heartache. I did get a house eventually. I did take the bad guy's house. And I lived in it for a couple of years.
Really? How did it make you feel to be, like, in the bedroom of the bad guy? Why would you do that? Of all houses you could choose.
It was kind of a nice house. It was in Rancho Santa Fe, which is this nice area of, yes, that's true, a nice area of San Diego. And I just, I don't know, you know, there was something to it because he tormented me so much. Yeah, there was a little redemption. I mean, some of it was functional. Some might be dysfunctional. I sold it a couple of years ago.
Your income stream has been kind of erratic, it seems. You haven't had a steady flow of income.
I have not, and banks are always saying something to me about that.
Was there a time after you started Match.com where you were worried about, you know, your financial state?
No, because I was always living pretty low. So I was living in the Western Edition section of San Francisco in a $300 share, and I was eating burritos for years and years and years. So I kept my burn rate super, super low. And the landlord didn't like the fact that I wasn't making any money. And I don't know. So I'm actually sometimes a nice person. So I met this like semi-homeless guy and I let him sleep on my couch for a couple days. And he took some pictures of the guy leaving and he tried to evict me.
You have since moved away from the dating and the adult industry to a cleaner energy, the cleaner energy sector. How have you made that shift? Was it a mindful shift or an accidental one?
Well, I've always been interested in not always the energy part, but sustainable living and systems that would work forever and that were light touch on the environment, kind of the leaving no trace. I've always had an interest in that area. So just after I sold sex.com, I invested in a friend's company, and she had women-friendly solar panels was her idea. So I gave her money to kind of produce these, well, what I thought they were going to be mustard or taupe-colored solar panels, racking systems, because her belief was that women were some of the big decision makers in the purchase of solar, and they're ugly. And if they made it, and it made sense to me. So what happened was not as many people were buying the mustard or taupe-colored panels as she thought. And I asked her why. And I go, aren't you selling to all these rich people? She said they don't have the money up front for it. Hmm. And I had this epiphany of the idea of why not create a financing company to finance solar panels. And if the financing product would be correctly designed, the consumers would pay less than the cost of energy from their utility bill, and they'd want to sign up for that. And that actually worked out. I wrote some software that helped the installer do their job, and then they all ran this software, and then we introduced the financing product eventually. I mean, there was a lot of twists and turns.
Now, Kleiner Perkins is one of the investors in this company. Who are the other venture folks?
Claremont Creek Ventures, Google, Clean Pacific Ventures, and a lot of individual angels, including myself.
Were you at all worried that your reputation would be tainted in this new chapter of yours as you were raising capital, for instance?
I was a little bit. The good news is investors want to make money, and, you know, any challenges in reputation stop when you have a good idea. They want to make money. They don't care about the past as much, I found. Hmm. As an investor, I'm kind of like that, too.
This time around, you brought in a CEO. You knew you didn't want to be the CEO. Is that just a matter of growing up? I mean, you were 30. You were in your late 20s, early 30s when you were launching Match.com and trying to run it. Is there anything else that is attributable to this change?
Well, I've heard, Jessica, if someone hits you on the head enough times, you remember, like, oh, I don't want to be hit on the head. So I remembered, I'm not that good of a manager of people. Why don't I find someone who is a good manager of people?
Now, your other company, Sociogramics, which you launched in 2010, is a financial service company that facilitates lending to the underbanked. And you're using social media tools to help determine credit worthiness. What's an example of a social media tool that you might use to influence responsible borrowing?
Let me give you a really clear example. Today, when someone applies for a loan, if they can't find them at the credit bureau, they're usually just denied unilaterally. But there's a lot of people who aren't in the credit bureau or don't have an extensive credit file. We believe that using social media, finding their profiles out there and other traces of them and other ways of verifying they're real people with real jobs, that's good enough reasons to lend to them.
Your idea for Sociogramics came from a personal place. What is that story briefly?
So I had a great relationship with a bank in Marin, California. And I knew the officers there. They knew my story. They knew my situation. And they could tailor products and services to me. The bank got taken over by a large bank, Union Bank. And it was like night and day difference. Instead of talking to the CEO when I had a need or my representative, it was a call center. And the relationship soured quickly. And it got me thinking why the personal touch is not only important from the consumers, it's important from the bank side. So I got thinking, is there a way we could use software to bring back community lending? One of our ideas is start bringing back essays and having people write about what they're going to do with the money and what's there been history of repayment. And I think there's a lot of efficacy to that.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
I'm honored to be here, Jessica.
My guest has been Gary Krimen. Coming up, we'll meet Roy and Bertrand Sosa, co-founders of NetSpend. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Roy and Bertrand Sosa, co-founders of NetSpend, the first prepaid debit card company for the underbanked population in the United States. NetSpend was launched in 1999 and targets people who don't have access to credit cards or hold bank accounts. Roy and Bertrand started the company out of their one-bedroom apartment in Texas with $750. They later raised $1.5 billion in an IPO in 2010 and sold the company in early 2013 to Total System Services, a payment processing company, for approximately $1.4 billion. They are the co-founders of Empower Ventures, an investment fund focused on financial service companies for the underbanked. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica.
You immigrated from Mexico to the United States in 1986 when you were teenagers. What were your first impressions of America, Bertrand?
As the World Turns, because I learned English watching As the World Turns with my mother. And the other parts came from watching Transformers in the morning.
How about you, Roy?
Missing the bus, going to my first day of school in Austin, Texas, and having my tennis shoes stolen and not speaking the language. Yeah, it was not a good start. Pretty tough when coming back from a country where, for me, everything clicked.
Now, you moved from Mexico with your mother, and she wanted to kind of reinvent herself. She had been working in business administration, and she wanted to study medicine. Where was your father in this?
Our father, he's a professor of economics, and so they had split a few years back, and so he was in Mexico City.
Roy, you joined the Marine Corps after high school, before entering college. Given your allegiance to Mexico, why did you join the Marines?
Literally, Saddam had invaded Kuwait, and I had been in this country for 4 years, and I had really come to the conclusion that whereas before I wanted to get back to Mexico as soon as possible, I had come to just love this country and the opportunities. And I felt that there was no way that I was ever really going to feel that this was my home the same way that my peers that have been born here. And so I just had this idea of what better way than join the Marines during time of war.
after college, you both worked at MCI, the telephone company.
Now Verizon.
It was at MCI that the idea for Netspend hatched. And it seems like you are both very unlikely people to start a financial services company, especially given that you were at a telephone company and you didn't have a background in financial services. How did the idea for Netspend come to be?
We were living together at the time when we overlapped work at MCI WorldCom, and we were just talking about the internet boom and how there's a new business being hatched every day, it seemed like. And so you can imagine, especially in Austin, Texas, Michael Dell has just entered into the picture. And without living in Austin, I don't know if we would have had the momentum of entrepreneurship that we felt. Literally, it happened over a few days where we started talking about doing something together. I remember him walking into my room and saying, I got it. Mm-hmm. We're going to enable payments over the internet.
At the time, e-commerce was just blooming. And people were starting to buy things online. However, there was this whole population of people who didn't have access to credit cards. And the thought was, how are they going to transact? In what way did this stem from your own experience or frustration with the payment system?
As a student at the University of Texas and having had financial aid checks coming in from my GI Bill, I had come to understand that if I came in and I deposited my $2,000 check at my bank account, deposited my check on Friday at 4 p.m., guess what? Even though I had a debit card, I could not get the funds to clear my account until after midnight Monday, which puts it Tuesday. So if I needed to buy books on the internet, or if I wanted to buy flowers for my girlfriend from 1-800-Flowers, I couldn't do anything. The electronics seem to be there. They have my money. Why? Why can't I do this? And that was really what motivated us to say, we cannot possibly be the only ones.
While it was the early days, prepaid cards did exist in the form of phone cards, for example. And in what way did phone cards inspire you to just apply it to a different area?
In a big way for me. I mean, we were working directly in the industry, and we had context coming from Mexico where you know, very popular way of transacting.
When we were at MCI, one of our college jobs initially was to sign people up to switch in long distance. And curiously enough, switching people from AT&T to MCI, that was easy. The ones that were super difficult were not only immigrants, but your average American that had gotten a $400, $500 phone bill, and they couldn't pay it. And they had gotten so burned with that experience that they decided, you know what, I'm going to buy prepaid cards. And we could tell that customer, Mr. Customer, you know, you can have the service for 5 cents a minute, and the prepaid card is 30 cents. And the customer would tell us, yes, I know. I know it's more expensive, but you know what? When I'm done with the card, I'm done with the card.
More control.
It's control. As a person, I have problems about maybe not exercising enough, maybe not having the right diet. And certainly, I'm going to have a problem with spending and saving. And if you can give me something where I can have control, that would be very powerful.
You launched the company with $750, which is basically the amount of money that it costs to incorporate.
$750 was utilized to incorporate, and that was really the catalyst to no going back.
So we put a list of friends and family, and it's really funny, the 20 people that we put on the list, they ended up not giving us any money. But what we ended up getting, these first investors are former employees at MCI. So think about people that were call center agents. When you're talking about an investment from a friend or a former employee that is $5,000 when their annual income, I know for a fact because it used to work for me, was $60,000, it's a big deal.
And then you looked to venture capital and you got a lot of no's because you didn't have experience. What were some other reasons why venture folks did not support you initially?
I'll give you the response that we got from one particular investor that we were looking for money from. And he looked at us and he said, you guys are hilarious. It's like you're trying to go to the Super Bowl and win, but you've got two players. I mean, I didn't even know what venture capital was mm-hmm. when we were looking for venture capital.
You ended up raising money from the help of the Small Business Administration. They had this SBIC program, which insured investments from venture funds, right? It backed or collateralized investments from venture funds. Is that right?
That is correct.
They supported one of our investors, early investors. They had received some money from the government, and it turned out that we were one of the portfolio companies of the year for the government.
And who was the venture firm?
Jeffenor.
Jeffenor here out of New York.
In the early days, you persuaded MasterCard to partner with you. How did you meet them?
We were introduced to them by our partner bank out of Texas.
And to their credit, they were very open. You got to remember, 1998, the internet is expanding. And back in those days, we basically said, look, we have an agreement with ExxonMobil for distribution of these cards. They need to be able to get their cash into the system. And how are you going to deal with that? And if you don't want to help us, that's fine. But then this is our first stop, and maybe we can go to American Express, or maybe we can go to Visa, but somebody's going to do it.
So Exxon was a real important ally for you in convincing the likes of MasterCard to work with you.
ExxonMobil being Fortune 1.
So, for example, when you think about MasterCard or Visa, they do not issue cards. Banks do. The biggest retail bank in America back then had a total of 5,000 branches. ExxonMobil had 15,000 locations. So the concept that you can actually reach people through a retail location instead of a bank branch was really an innovation in itself. The other thing that we also had was our technology. So because the stuff that we wanted to do had never been done before, the incumbents, they were very rigid. If you as a bank said, I want to change this and that, they would say, okay, we can make those changes, but it's going to cost you millions of dollars and it's going to be 2-3 years. They also were operating on mainframes. We had the benefit of, we were working on servers from the internet age, where instead of spending $20 million on infrastructure, we could do it for a couple million dollars faster, better.
How did you convince Exxon to make your cards available to the population?
They took a leap of faith on a pilot in Texas. And so literally hopped on a plane, went to see them in Fairfax, Virginia, said, hey, we want to do this. Here's a card. I remember putting a card in front of the gentleman that handled U.S. distribution for their C-stores. He picked it up, looked at it. This, by the way, had been a card that I had designed personally and printed and laminated and all that. And I remember he looked at it and said, okay, let's do it. And he signed the term sheet.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Bertrand and Roy Sosa, co-founders of NetSpend, a pioneer of prepaid debit cards for the underbanked. Launched in 1999, NetSpend provides cards and other financial services to people who don't have access to credit or bank accounts. It occurred to me that you are innovating at the bottom of the pyramid. You're serving people who have real needs, and one day these services will be or eventually were used by mainstream customers. And usually when we think of innovation, sometimes it happens top down, like at the top of the pyramid, and then eventually, you know, the people at the bottom would benefit. Have you thought about that dynamic?
We have. Today, globally, we now have programs in places like Kosovo, where we completely help rebuild the entire financial system in terms of the infrastructure for card issuance and acceptance. And, you know, the small business owner that now can order enzymes for his dairy business that he couldn't before.
Enzymes,
yeah. And that he couldn't do it before. And you asked this question of, you know, you started innovating at the bottom of the pyramid. Well, we have to be super low cost. You obviously can't talk about big fees. We have programs where literally we make $1 per customer per year. Okay, so for you to make it work, you have to leverage technology. You have to leverage partnerships. But once you do that, then all of a sudden you say, wow, I can actually deliver services to the top of the pyramid more efficiently, better service than the incumbents that have been used to high fees, because I had to figure it out. So instead of building a branch, I partnered with a grocery store. Instead of building a branch, I partnered with an airline.
Or a telco.
Or a telco.
You are no longer affiliated with NetSpend. you started an investment fund called Empower, which invests in financial service companies serving the underbanked population. And unfortunately, it got off to a rough start in that you were the subject of a lawsuit and injunctions were filed against you from Netspend, from the very company that you founded. And that was a tumultuous period for you, I'm sure. And the company contended that you were taking employees and that you had a non-compete and that you were starting companies that competed directly with Netspend. What was your response to that?
No, my two cents on that is that it was a silly time for both of us. There was just no reason for it. We cleared the air between both sides.
The short answer is I can tell you all those things were dismissed. But at the same time, I will also tell you, because of confidentiality and the dismissal and whatnot, we really don't talk about it. But I can tell you from a human perspective, it is the equivalent of being sued by your child. For me, it was even more awkward as a founder to think about the fact that, okay, at the time, we were the largest individual shareholders. So if Netspend won, we lost. But if Netspend lost, we lost. And it just didn't make sense. You know, I've never sued anybody in my entire life. To me, it's disappointing when companies or individuals view the game as a zero sum. Like, if you're winning, I must be losing. So how do I get a piece of that? Netspend had the opportunity to go international for many years. Never did. There's nothing that prevents them from doing that.
So what you're saying is Netspend decided not to go into these other markets internationally, and there you saw an opportunity elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, we started doing things around mobile payments right away and going into other countries right away. And, you know, the product line spectrum that we have today is pretty significantly different than what you see back then.
Your focus now is on Rev Worldwide, which is a portfolio company of Empower, and they have a network of payment companies for those without access to banking. So similar to Netspend, but international. What are some examples, or who are some of the people whom are being affected by this?
In rural Mexico, there's no cell phone coverage. There's no mobile coverage. So we partnered with the telegraph company and with Huawei, who actually came in and put a satellite antenna, and we enabled everybody in a township of 500 families to be able to operate and be able to have both access to telecommunications, but also to the banking system.
The people in Mexico that are using the Mi Phone product are impacted in a very, very real way. I mean, you have this merchant that's selling chicken, and now because he's able to take phone orders and have them be paid to his cell phone, he doesn't have to go to collect the cash and then take the cash to the bank. And, you know, all these inefficiencies that when you think about, I mean, we may take them for granted, but when for somebody to go half a day across town, another half a day, come back, it's a big deal. Mm-hmm. It's a big deal in terms of time and money. And we have successfully bridged that divide through the mobile phone and through a debit card. Another way that Rev is impacting around the world, you're talking about cab drivers in Australia that are getting paid via their driver's card. Through our technology, their headquarters disperses the money directly to them. And, you know, I can go on and on about all the different examples.
Your mom is living in Texas currently. What does she make of all this?
It's really funny you ask that question, because throughout the early years at Netspend, I don't think she really understood what we were doing. When it relates to things about work, it's more about I need to, you know, help her reset her pen, or I get a tickle out of that every single time.
Where was your father in this?
My father, who's a professor, he still would like for me to go out and finish some sort of graduate school. He's never been a big pro-capitalist or entrepreneur supporter, so there's a bit of unfinished business there.
You said your father's a professor of economics in Mexico?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hmm. Is he socialist?
How did you guess? Why would have led you to believe that?
All you have to do is meet my mother and my father to understand why Roy is half mission-driven and half capitalistic-driven.
I grew up going to summer camps with the Boy Scouts, and every other year going to summer camps with the Cuban Pioneers. And I grew up with a poster of a $6 million man next to the poster of Ernesto Che Guevara.
They
go hand in hand. I don't think you divorce one from the other.
You guys are two immigrants from Mexico, and Netspend had a $1.5 billion IPO in 2010, and more recently was sold for almost $1.5 billion. Were you like, is this really happening to me?
Yeah, all the time. You know, what I really pinch myself is, it's not necessarily the IPO or Netspend or the prepaid. I pinch myself that I was able to find the path of entrepreneurship. When I discovered that entrepreneurs, it wasn't necessarily a dirty word, but it was a very, again, a very empowering feeling, it blew my mind.
I want to elaborate on that concept of dirty word. From an entrepreneur's perspective, in Mexico, an entrepreneur is somebody who doesn't know what they want to do. Being an entrepreneur is the guy that is just sort of wheeling and dealing. And so it's fantastic to really have come to a country at a time where this is really exploding. And if you can believe that, a couple of Mexican immigrants that came in on a tourist visa, that the visa had an expiration date, and that by all means should not be here, that we could create a company that could lead an industry that could create so many jobs.
That is extremely empowering.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
My guests have been the financial service entrepreneurs, Roy and Bertrand Sosa. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.